Record. Great. Well, thank you all for being here. Welcome to Insurance 101, which is a program that is building on our fall HICPE 101 training that was in person in New York. So hopefully some of you joining today were able to join that program as well. This is a new component to HICPE 101, whereby we'll be offering virtual programming throughout your first year as part of HICPE and as part of your organization. So excited to kick that off today with two of our great strategic partners, Gallagher and McDermott Will and Emery, who are here with us today. I'm Melissa Gardner. I'm the executive director of HICPE, and Leslie Thornbury, who is also on the line, is a director at HICPE. And we are excited that you all are here today and want to thank our sponsors. And with that, we'll turn it over to Lee to get us started.
Great. Thanks, Melissa. Thanks, everybody, for joining. Really appreciate your time. As Melissa said, Lee Newmark from Gallagher. I'm the lead for Gallagher and the HICPE strategic partnership that we've enjoyed now for a little over a year. And my area of responsibility is really focusing on the commercial side of the insurance world, things on more of the post-close that we won't get into today. But I've got a number of my teammates on as well that I'll let Aaron and Dylan introduce themselves and go ahead and get started with the content here. So thank you for the time, Aaron.
Yeah, hey everyone. Glad to be here. Aaron Zide with Gallagher. I head up our transactional team, transactional risk team. So focused on rep and warranty insurance, tax liability, contingent liability, everything to help you get through a transaction smoothly. The bulk of the work is rep and warranty insurance, and looking forward to giving everyone a little bit, having a discussion about that today.
And hey everyone, Dylan Sotka at Gallagher. My specific responsibility at Gallagher is solely with respect to management liability, executive liability, cyber liability, and professional liability. So for those who know a little bit about property and casualty insurance, most of that insurance has to do with damages which are physical in nature. Something has broke, someone has been injured, for which insurance is sending insurance dollars to the rescue. But there are also many other insurance losses where financial losses are in question. And so those are my areas of specialization, particularly directors and officers liability, which we'll spend a little bit of time on towards the end of the presentation. So looking forward to it.
Hey everyone, a quick intro from our team as well. This is June. I'm a partner at the corporate group here with McDermott. I specialize in representing private equity clients in connection with mergers and acquisitions and divestitures, etc. And I'm excited to be here.
Yeah, and my name is Nate. I'm also a partner here at McDermott Will and Emery in the New York office where June and I are located. I also specialize in mergers and acquisitions and specifically with private equity transactions. So we'll just jump right into it. We thought, as just a basic primer to start off the presentation, it'd be helpful to provide just a broad overview of what is a representation and warranty and what is an indemnity. So, at its most basic level, a representation is just a statement of fact upon which the other party may rely on. And specifically, in the context of a purchase agreement, when you're buying and selling a company, right, the buyers and sellers are providing representations to each other. The most important representations are about the company, the target that is actually being sold in connection with the transaction, right? As a buyer, you want to know what are, if there's any material liability. You want to know what the capitalization table is. You want to know if there's any environmental issues, if there's any IP issues. And so you ask the seller to give you representations with respect to all of that in the purchase agreement. And for all of you who have dealt with purchase agreements and past deals, you know this is oftentimes the longest portion of the purchase agreement. And it can be, 10 to 30 pages, depending on how many reps you're getting on the company. Historically, it tends to be one of the most negotiated portions of the purchase agreement. We'll talk about this a bit later, but rep and warranty insurance has actually lessened the amount that this portion of the agreement is actually negotiated because, as we'll hear about in more detail, the RWI insurance actually kind of replicates the indemnity and the risk that's typically associated to the seller in connection with making the reps. In the reps, there's affirmative statements, which is something like, the seller, the company, we hold all the material permits needed to operate the business. There's negative reps, which, the company is not in violation of any material laws. And then what you'll oftentimes see is exceptions, which is, except as disclosed on Schedule XYZ, the company is not party to any material litigation. And I think the right way to think about disclosure schedules, I know there can oftentimes be confusion there, is that it's really just a part of the purchase agreement. It's just instead of listing that actually in the document, which would make, turn it from 30 pages of reps to 45 pages of reps, we just set those items on a schedule and that's separately negotiated. And at its core, I think the reps and warranties really do two things fundamentally. One, it's a diligence exercise and it provides the buyer with a basic understanding of the target. They want to buy, as a buyer, you want to know what you're buying. You want to know what the assets are. You want to know if there's any material liabilities and if there's any risk that you're taking by acquiring the company. And two, it acts as a mechanism to allocate that risk between the buyer and the seller, which we'll hear about in a little bit from June. When do the reps need to be true? The most lawyerly answer that I can provide is it depends. Typically, as a buyer, you want them to be true at signing and at closing so that you can get coverage for pre-signing breaches and also for breaches during that interim period. And then what happens if the statement is false? And again, this is a it depends. It depends on what sort of rep and warranty coverage you have. It depends on if there's an indemnification from the seller and what's actually negotiated in the purchase agreement. So I'll hand it off to June to talk a little bit more about indemnification specifically.
Yeah, so look, we mentioned that reps and warranties provide a way to allocate risks as between the seller and the buyer, right? So how does that actually work in practice? So one way to do that is through what you call an indemnity. So many of you have probably heard about contractual indemnities, but in the context of a rep and warranty insurance presentation, the way it actually comes into play is as a promise, right? It's a promise by one party to compensate the other party when for any damages that arise where the indemnifying parties' reps and warranties have been breached. So let me give an example. You have a seller rep that says prior to the signing date, the target company has never been party to any litigation. So post-closing, once you close the deal, it actually turns out that the company was indeed a named defendant in a large litigation. So then the court ends up ruling against the company, which results in the company that you just bought being responsible for damages of, let's say, $1 million. So here, there's a clear breach of the no litigation rep. The seller rep that it was not a party to any litigation, and then post-closing, it turns out that was false. It was actually party to a litigation. And that litigation ended up resulting in damages in a full walk-away deal. So this is one where there is no indemnity that is being provided by seller. After the closing, buyer would have no recourse with respect to this particular breach, and it would have to eat up all of its damages. Now, this assumes you don't have claims for fraud, which is a totally different presentation, whole topic. But assuming, there's no fraud claim here, then buyer would have no recourse against the seller, even though seller ended up providing a representation that ended up not being true. In an indemnity scenario, this is one where the seller has agreed to provide an indemnity to buyer for its breaches of reps and warranties. The seller would be responsible for compensating buyer for all of that $1 million worth of damages. So, as you can see from my example, where you do have a contractual indemnity, the seller would, the actual risk of the unknown here being the litigation that we found out after we closed, that would shift to the seller. So it's a neat way of building in a mechanism for you to be able to shift that risk with respect to known issues or unknown issues. Another example, let's assume that, like Nate described, seller went through the disclosure exercise and specified a pending liability in the disclosure schedules against this rep. So that really means that because they listed it in the disclosure schedules, this pending litigation acts as an exception to the representation that seller has no litigation. Now, this is a known liability, and one way for buyer to shift that risk back to the seller is for buyer to request an indemnity from seller to indemnify buyer in respect of this known liability. So we talked about shifting risk for unknown risks and shifting liability for known risks. So now, why are we doing this presentation? Reps and warranty, what can they help solve? They can help essentially cover and replace a contractual indemnity in respect of unknown risks. So in the former example I told you about, a rep and warranty insurance can effectively do the same thing without you having to legislate a contractual indemnity in the purchase agreement. So we can move on to the next slide. Gallery team, we'll
Yep.
hand it over to you.
Yeah, that was a real helpful overview of reps and warranties and indemnification in the purchase agreement. So, as the name implies, with rep and warranty insurance, the purpose of the product is to cover unknown breaches of the seller's reps and warranties. It's not there to cover these known issues, but it does so by supplementing or replacing a traditional seller indemnity. Again, we stress unknown issues because the coverage is ultimately dependent on the buyer's due diligence process. The expectation is the buyers are going to run a robust due diligence process. So customary due diligence on legal, financial, tax, insurance, benefits, to the extent applicable to that particular target. They might cover environmental matters, IT, cyber, so on and so forth. So if you look a little bit at this timeline, the product's really been around for 20 plus years. In the early days, it was there really to save deals that had gone bad. Underwriting was pretty clunky, pricing was pretty expensive. And they were real challenging deals, right? Insurers would get calls to support transactions that, like I said, had really gone bad. So not relatively obscure product in the early days. Early 2010s, private equity sellers saw this as a financial opportunity, financial play to start and started pushing the product. So in rather than a seller putting up 10% of the purchase price in escrow to cover losses that arise from a breach of a representation, they've asked buyers to go out and get a rep and warranty policy. I think in the early stages, in a competitive auction process, like potential buyers contemplating a rep and warranty insurance policy was really an offensive move. Nowadays, as it's become the norm in M&A, it's essentially table stakes, right? If you're not contemplating rep and warranty insurance, I think it's a real struggle to put up a competitive offer. And if you look at the chart on the right, the rep and warranty primary policies bound since 2015. I mean, you kind of see the hockey stick there. Decreased adoption rate, not only by financial buyers, but strategic buyers. Has really grown over the last 5 years, becoming the norm in middle market M&A. Traditionally, the sweet spot has been deals, priced 50 million to 750 million in enterprise value, but appetite to, the use of that product on both sides of that transaction value has grown enormously. And look, I think, one of the reasons that it's become so widely accepted is, we touched on this earlier, right? It eases the negotiation of the reps and warranties, so as well as the indemnity. So anything that's going to help on that negotiation is super helpful. But it's a highly competitive market. You've got 2 dozen plus carriers that are now in this space. The coverage is expanded over time. It's a very buyer-friendly product. And everyone's working on deal time, right? You have sophisticated underwriters and brokers who, for the most part, are former M&A attorneys and can execute on deal time. Next slide. And then in terms of benefits of the coverage, look, on the sell side, I think it's pretty clear, right? It's in lieu of holding back, upwards of 10% of the purchase price, and we'll get into this a little bit later. The sellers can either get, more or less a walk-away deal subject to customary fraud carve-outs, or they might share in the policy's deductible, which, again, when compared to a significant portion of the purchase price, is a very limited seller indemnity. But on the buy side, there's all sorts of benefits as well, right? So typically we see policy limits at 10 to 20% of the purchase price. There's flexibility there. So to the extent that the buyer wants to obtain a policy limit significantly more than they would get a seller to hell with a traditional indemnity, I mean that capital is there. It extends the survival periods of the rep. So typically 3 years for the general reps, 6 years for fundamental and tax reps, and a customary pre-closed tax indemnity. We see this product used on a number of deals where there's a significant shareholder rollover. In that case, the buyer is no longer going to need to seek recourse for loss from their new business partners. They can look to an insurance policy to make them whole. And again, like benefits of both parties, right? Eases negotiation of not only the reps, but the indemnity. There's more or less a market set of reps, representations, and warranties that the insurers are willing to cover. Ultimately, they're looking to see something that's fair and balanced, more middle of the road, and that's kind of on an insured deal that the both parties are entering with that in mind.
And Aaron, just to chime in there, what kind of stood out to me is what you just mentioned, the rollover piece, where the bullet says buyer wants to protect key relationships. So in a traditional indemnity where you are getting recourse or seeking recourse against the sellers, who often end up being founders or physicians who are an integral part of the business that you're actually buying. I.e., where the rollover is high, it's often awkward kind of going after them and asking them for money. And you can avoid all of that by being able to go after the insurers instead. And so it's a wonderful product for purposes of ensuring that you maintain those relationships, that you don't necessarily have to go through the exercise of figuring out, look, is this even worth angering our big stakeholders here just because they ended up breaching a rep, or should we just not do it? So this is it bridges that gap as well, and so it's a great product for that.
Yeah, that's a great point. And not only just, on rollover deals, but if you've got a distressed deal or you've got, another, financial seller that's just not going to be there, there's no funds that are going to be there post-close. Again, just having, an independent third party insurer available to make the buyers whole it makes this product useful on all sorts of transactions.
All right, so we will talk about some of the basics from our perspective. So, as I mentioned earlier, these policies can help replace contractual indemnities to protect against unknown risks. So what do they cover? What do these policies cover? They cover reps and warranties of sellers and/or the target company, and they cover those reps that are given in the purchase agreement. And sometimes in some ancillary transaction documents. For example, you might have a letter of transmittal in a merger setting or a rollover agreement. And to the extent key reps are being given in those ancillary documents, the rep and warranty insurance is able to cover those as well. What they do not cover are known matters. So in my prior example about litigation and the company having been party to a or a named defendant in a key litigation that ended up being disclosed, rep and warranty insurance is not going to cover that. They don't cover what's a known risk. I think the Gallagher team, feel free to chime in if there are products that can help kind of provide additional coverage for whatever is known. But you know, I think the default would be that known matters do not get coverage. And this is also true in respect of not just items that are scheduled in the disclosure schedules, but also issues that are known to the buyer's deal team. So if a buyer is aware of a rep having been breached at the time of signing, it doesn't matter if the breach is disclosed or not. The fact that the buyer's deal team knows about it means that the insurers are not going to be able to provide coverage with respect to it. So those are some key basics around coverage. Obviously, there's a lot that goes into you know, the details of what exactly gets covered as a fundamental rep, as a non-fundamental rep. We'll get into that later. But I think as a general matter, probably the biggest takeaway is that if you are aware of a known issue, then rep and warranty insurance is not going to be able to provide coverage with respect to it. Pausing here for a second in case Aaron or Dylan or Lee, you guys have anything else to add on this?
June, it's Dylan at Gallagher. I was hoping maybe you would also just talk about how underlying insurance fits into the situation. I know we've talked about known and unknown circumstances, but underlying insurance also fits into that, I feel like, a little bit as well. So maybe 3 minutes there could be useful.
Feel free to kind of provide some details around that, Dylan.
Yeah, I mean, I can jump in, right? So look, the rep and warranty insurance policy, one, isn't a substitute for due diligence, right? Because it's going to cover it, you know, like it's not going to cover known issues. And we should say it's, you know, policy exclusions, they really shouldn't come as any surprise, right? They're going to be specifically tailored to that specific known issue that gets uncovered in due diligence. So for example, there's a sales tax issue in Minnesota, right? That policy exclusion should be limited to that sales tax issue in that particular state, right? There's not going to be some broad carve out that excludes all tax reps. And then again, so one, not a substitute for due diligence, and two, should not be a substitute for other commercially available insurance products. So you're talking about claims made coverages, D&O, E&O, cyber, environmental. You know, again, very buyer friendly, insured friendly environments. Ultimately, the insurers want to understand that the target has an adequate insurance program and that there's customary claims made coverages have been put into runoff or tail to cover pre-closed liabilities. So they would be the first line of defense, if available, to the extent there's a rep breach in that coverage, is there, like I said, is a first line of defense as opposed to just going after the rep and warranty insurance policy. And
This is
without
a
getting too far in the weeds, you know, I think in a more insurer friendly market, they would specifically sit excess of underlying coverages, where possible, given the nature of this particular target's, you know, operations. But generally speaking, that's not a position they're taking now. So the policy, the rep and warranty policy, will have another insurance provision that says, buyer's going to seek recourse from those other coverages first, and then the rep and warranty insurance policy would respond.
And I feel like a place we see this a lot is in medical manufacturing, specifically with respect to existing product liability insurance and kind of the interplay between RWI and that existing policy that's in place for product manufacturing failures during the pre-closing period.
Yeah, and I guess to add to what everyone said, I think it's a great point. I mean, the first question that the insurers are going to ask is how thorough of a diligence process you as the buyer have run, right? And they will often require written diligence reports from a legal perspective. And this goes into the timing of when to start engaging all of this and what the process is going to look like. But you often will definitely need a very comprehensive legal diligence memo. The insurers will similarly require evidence of thorough diligence from all of the buyer's other advisors. So to your point, the rep and warranty insurance is definitely not a substitute for diligence. It's the other way around. They would only provide coverage to the extent you have run sufficient diligence. So that's one point. That's great. And secondly, to the extent there are exclusions, yes, you have these first lines of defense, which are other insurance policies that are in place with the target, potentially excess coverage and whatnot. But the ultimate, from a buyer's perspective, the last resort remains the seller. Sellers are going to negotiate hard against that. But if this is a negotiated point that you as the buyer end up winning, then you do get the ability to go after the seller once you've try to recover against all of these other areas of recovery. So yeah, I think those are kind of the basics of the scope of coverage generally. And yeah, I think, do you want to talk about survival periods?
Yeah. So, the question then arises, you have your indemnification, you have your RWI policy. How long after closing are you able to bring a claim under this policy? And the typical length, and this is what we call the survival of the rep. And the typical length is for general representations, which I'll talk about in a second. It would be 3 years after the closing. And for fundamental representations, tax reps, and your pre-closing tax indemnity, what you typically see is 6 years. And these aren't just arbitrary numbers. They kind of mirror the statute of limitations in Delaware and New York, and they also replicate what historically the survival periods that sellers would provide in purchase agreements when there was no rep and warranty insurance. So the product really replicates the indemnification that the sellers, would otherwise be providing. So talk a little bit about general representations and fundamentals. I'll touch very briefly on this. The fundamental reps are the representations that are so important to the deal that as a buyer, you really wouldn't do the transaction if you knew they were false. And this is things like the seller has authority to enter into their transaction. The company is duly formed and in good standing. The capitalization is correct. And so these reps are deemed more important. And so they typically have broader and longer coverage under the representation warranty policy. Moving on to the right side of the screen. So we'll talk specifically about market and deal specific exclusions. Aaron touched on this a little bit, but there's going to be customary exclusions that no underwriter is going to provide coverage for under their policy. And this is things like asbestos and PCBs, underfunding of defined pension plans, non-availability of any tax assets such as NOLs. And these are items that underwriters have just determined, they're way too risky and the magnitude of losses is too great to actually provide coverage for it under the policy. So those are customary exclusions. And then what you have is deal-specific exclusions. And June talked about this. These are things that are discovered during the underwriting process, the diligence process, that, again, they're known liabilities that the underwriter isn't going to take the risk on. And so they're going to say these are excluded from coverage. As a buyer, you then have the option to go ask the seller to stand behind those representations, or ask for a specific indemnity to where if there are losses associated with those excluded matters, the seller would have to indemnify you specifically for those damages. And then focus on insurers underwriting. So this is, I think, a really important preliminary planning piece of the underwriting process. When your broker goes out to the market, they're going to hear back from a host of potential underwriters, and they're going to say, based on the industry that the target company operates in, these are areas of focus that we're going to be really, really honed in on because we think there's greater risk here, given the industry. And so for healthcare, private equity professionals such as yourself, oftentimes you're going to see healthcare compliance, billing and coding. For medical manufacturing, product liability is a big one. And it's important to understand and have this discussion with your brokers and lawyers upfront is, okay, we know these areas are going to be, the underwriters are going to be hyper-focused on. So we want to make sure that we're doing sufficient diligence here to get them comfortable on underwriting these reps. So whether that means bringing in additional third-party advisors specific to billing and coding or specific to the manufacturing process, whatever it be, it's making sure you understand where the focus is and that you're planning accordingly. And Aaron, Dylan, I'm sure you guys have additional items to add there as well from a broker perspective.
Yeah, no, that's a real good point. And it can be a bit confusing when we put these summaries together, because you have your deal specific exclusions, which at this point really are none, aside, like insurers aren't going to put out a quote unless they're not intending to take any deal specific exclusions except, customary exclusions where applicable, right? And then you'll have a bunch of bullets that lay out the areas that they think are, of a heightened risk. And we'll put together a summary of three or four top insurers. And sometimes, clients will see, well, this insurer's got six bullet points, this one has two. I think we all kind of know going in, given the nature of each target's operations, like what we should be taking a little bit of a deeper dive on. But, at the end of the day, they're still expecting the buyer to substantiate the accuracy of all the reps on all the subject matters in the purchase agreement. So we try not to get too far into the weeds. We know who's a little bit better at working at what, with what in underwriting, and some insurers have prefer to see certain vendors do billing coding audits. So, that's where we can really, weigh in before we get an insurer lined up to underwrite.
I was just going to say that's a key area to consider when picking between insurers. We do often work with brokers and their clients often ask the question, right? Like, okay, we have this summary here. There's heightened areas of focus on these particular areas. They have three less than XYZ insurer. But in reality, and this is where, Aaron, your team comes into play very helpfully. You're able to kind of provide an overlay and a voiceover as to, things to consider outside of those specific terms, such as, okay, fine, they list something as heightened area of review, but the reality is they're pretty lean on those things. Or, from our experience, they've been very, commercial with respect to these particular customer exclusions. They're able to kind of tighten around the edges there. So things like that, I think we always end up kind of asking the question, or the client does, and we often get very helpful responses that can help us kind of pick the right insurer, and not just based on the specific terms they provide in their end bills, but based on real experience. So.
Yeah, I mean, I think in addition to claims experience with the insurers and the group that we're looking at is that's obviously a key component, but just user-friendliness, right? Who's the easiest to work with? And when we think about that, ultimately the insurers typically all get to the same spot or coverage position, but some can just get there a little bit quicker, which is going to save time and save fees. So yeah, we try to put those at the top of the list.
Great. I think this is all we had on this slide, so we can go on the next one.
All right, so the next slide just touches on the economics a little bit. So as we've said, the policy supplements or replaces a traditional seller indemnity. Again, limits typically 10 to 20% of the purchase price. I will say for our financial clients, financial buyers, they typically stick to that 10% of enterprise value when it comes to the policy limits. Some of our more conservative strategic buyers will take out a higher limit as a percentage of the transaction value, but let's just assume 10% here. In this example, we've got a $100 million transaction with a $10 million policy limit. The rates, we're in a very low rate environment or coming out of a very low rate environment. So, in the 2.5 to 3.5% range. So that means on a $10 million limit, the premium is going to be 250 to 350,000. I would say, healthcare opportunities generally are priced a little bit higher, 20, 30 basis points than other operating companies. I think, healthcare opportunities, financial institution targets, businesses that are heavily regulated and subject to, fines that can blow through a policy limit pretty quickly if something went wrong, those are priced a little bit higher. But that's kind of your premium is in that $250,000 to $350,000 range for a $10 million limit. And then the policy's deductible or retention also all-time lows. Historically, it's been 1% of enterprise value dropping to 50 basis points after 12 months. Which is typically the survival period for the general reps on an insured deal. And the reason it steps down after 12 months is most frequently the buyer and the seller will share in the policy's retention. So I guess just for ease of numbers, let's use 1% drop into 50 basis points. The buyer's basket in the purchase agreement would be 50 basis points or $500,000, and the seller's holdback would be the other 50 basis points or $500,000. So, to the extent there's a breach and loss, the policy's deductible first would get funded by the buyer's baskets and then by the seller's holdback. And to the extent that loss exceeds the policy's deductible, then it would respond. Again, that's just kind of round numbers, but where the market is today, we're seeing initial retentions at 50 basis points for deals as large as $100 million. So it's really come down. I would say 2 or 3 years ago, you couldn't get a deductible initial deductible that low unless the deal was at least a few $100 million. So very competitive. And again, from a seller's perspective, to the extent they're, it's a shared policy retention, or they're going to hold back half of the policy's deductible, as opposed to what they could potentially escrow on an uninsured deal, it's a significant cost savings, right? So the seller then can take that money, distribute it to partners, reinvest, what have you.
And Aaron, is it fair to say that historically, especially when rep and warranty insurance was first entering the market, nearly every deal, if not every deal, had seller bearing a portion of that retention? Is that right?
Yeah, I think at the outset, insurers wanted to see sellers have some skin in the game. And, I would say pre-COVID, until we really kind of hit a real frothy M&A market and very seller friendly, most of the deals, the parties split the policy's retention. It kind of flipped in end of 2020, 2021, where we were seeing more no seller indemnity public style deals. from a insurer's perspective, yes, they would like to see the sellers have some skin in the game, but ultimately, as long as the buyer can confirm that the sellers are disclosing without regard to materiality as part of the disclosure process, that generally gets them comfortable. Pre-2020, you might see a more significant increase in premium for a no seller indemnity deal versus a limited seller indemnity deal, but that really has come down. In some cases, it's really no difference, but at the most 10 to 20 basis points in terms of pricing.
Yeah, I know that's something that June and I have certainly seen a shift in, especially when representing private equity sponsors and competitive auction processes. Going in with a split retention and, even having the seller bear a portion of the RWI premium is seen as, negative marks on your bid. And that, most of the time, if we know there's other bidders in the auction, our clients are, willing to say we'll bear the entire portion of the retention, we'll bear the entire premium amount, just in order to essentially stay competitive and allow the seller to have what we call, in the industry, a full walk-away transaction.
Yeah, that's right. And I think, then the question is, are they going to get, is the buyer going to be able to get the seller to stand behind known issues, or is it just going to be limited to that, fraud carve out? And yeah, I mean, as the M&A market heats up, I can tell you already over the last few months, we can see kind of the shift from, more no seller public style deals hitting the market than the folks than the parties sharing in the policies retention. Again, not only there, but buyers more willing to say we're just going to pick up the cost of all policy costs. And then one other point is there's an underwriting fee in connection with each of these policies, typically $30,000 to $50,000, that gets paid to the insurer's outside advisors, typically counsel, sometimes financial advisors who assist in underwriting, non-refundable fee that, gets earned once an underwriting call occurs. But I think on a $10 million policy limit, kind of all in costs, you're in that 325 to 350,000, or I should say 350 to 375, including underwriting fee and surplus lines tax.
Great. So we're going to talk now about some recent trends in coverage terms. And we talked a little bit about it just now, the historical evolution of the product and how it's changed over time. I think, certainly COVID was a threshold moment in terms of deal volume, how people were thinking about risk allocation, the speed at which transactions started to go once kind of COVID restrictions got lifted, and coverage terms really changed at that point. And I think even now today, it's still very much a friendly RWI market, and we're seeing underwriters get more and more comfortable expanding the scope and policy terms that they're willing to provide. So this list is specific to June and I's experience on recent deals. It's definitely, I wouldn't say, representative of the entire market or what you should necessarily expect to receive on every deal, but these are some items that we've been able to push on with underwriters and get in our RWI policies for our clients. So the first one is zero retention for true fundamentals and being able to kind of push what the true fundamentals is. So we talked about, there being a retention throughout this presentation for the fundamental reps, which again are the reps that are so essential to the business and to the company that as a buyer, you wouldn't do the deal if they were known to be false. We're able to get no retention on those. So you're able to recover from the underwriter dollar one. And we've also been able to push the envelope on what a true fundamental is. And recently, I think getting title to assets, affiliate transactions, some of the reps that historically underwriters wouldn't consider as truly fundamental. I think the other thing that's important here is on the fundamentals is understanding the structure of your transaction. You have representations and warranties in your purchase agreement, but underwriters will also cover representations, warranties, and ancillary transaction documents. And specifically, this comes into play in connection with a merger, right? We're not going to nerd out too much on legal structure here, but in a merger, the seller's not a party to the purchase agreement, so they're not actually providing representations with respect to their ownership, their authority to enter into the transaction, that they're, a valid legal entity. But they do sign what's called a letter of transmittal, and in that document, they're providing those reps. And so oftentimes what we've been doing in recent deals is pushing to have that nil retention for true fundamentals cover the true fundamentals of the seller in those ancillary transaction documents. Another item on here is a synthetic definition for losses, irrespective of the definition in the purchase agreement. Again, I can't believe we got this, and I'm interested actually in Aaron, Dylan, Lee to hear your thoughts if you've seen this at all. But recently, we've been able to get a synthetic definition in the policy. And what this means is, as a seller, as a buyer, you want a broad definition of losses, which most often is no definition at all, and you want silence on it. And the underwriter will match that in the policy. As a seller, you want to exclude certain losses, such as consequential, special, punitive damages, so that you're not liable for those damages under the purchase agreement. And typically, if you have this definition that excludes these things in the purchase agreement, the underwriter will replicate that, and they don't want to provide a definition of losses that is broader than what the seller is willing to provide. In a recent deal, we were able to negotiate to have that seller-friendly losses definition, our purchase agreement, while still staying silent on it and having the broad definition under our RWI policy, which I was very pleasantly surprised that we were able to get. But again, I don't know, Aaron, Lee, Dylan, have you guys seen that at all, or is that just like an anomaly that happened?
No, we're seeing it more frequently. I wouldn't conflate, one market giving it to one insured or one law firm partner as something that's market. But this is really just, I mean, this slide just shows how competitive the market has become. For those of you that were around in tw end of 2021 and early 2022, there were just not enough bodies to underwrite all the deals that needed to get done. And we dealt with some surge pricing. So I talked about rates at 2.5 to 3%. I mean, we saw rates at 6 to 8%. And insurers just saying, we can't do this. We don't have any relationship with the buyer. It was a really bad situation. Fortunately, all the insurers were able to staff up. And of course, M&A volume trickled down, and then we were over, had overcapacity. So that's why you see this really historically low rate environment, all-time lows for policy deductibles. And these, items, nil retention on true fundamentals, synthetic definitions for loss, like this is the one way that the insurers can distinguish themselves from others. Also, how they comment or mark up the purchase agreement for purposes of the policy, right? So, I think I mentioned this earlier. We touched on it. The insurers want to see a well-negotiated agreement, reps that are middle of the road, not overly buyer-friendly. So, to the extent, it's too buyer-friendly, they will deem certain reps qualified by knowledge, deemed deleted, if it's a forward-looking statement or a financial guarantee. So these are kind of areas where the insurers have given because the rate can't go too low. They got to pay their claims. And the deductibles can't go too low either. So it's these, buyer-friendly little coverage enhancements. And, for repeat buyers, which is, key in our space, right? With financial buyers who are serial acquirers in the law firms and the brokers that, represent them on deals over and deals like, so we get these exceptions, but I wouldn't say the loss definition, synthetic definition of loss is market at this point, but you should be pushing on it where you can.
And I think that's my takeaway from this slide is you don't get what you don't ask for. And it's been interesting to see what 2 years ago even a year ago, I would have thought there's no chance we're going to get coverage for that or get those, buyer-friendly terms we've been able to recently get. So.
Yeah, we might get the note to tell the client or, counsel that this is a one-time accommodation.
Back-end fundamental reps. So just, I guess, as a reminder to all the professionals on the line, we care whether or not a representation gets fundamental treatment for a couple of reasons. So number one, fundamental reps, unlike regular reps, get a longer period to be able to make claims with respect to. So I think non-fundamental reps typically would get 3 years. Fundamental reps, you get up to 6 years to be able to make claims on. Secondly, I think like just like Nate just mentioned, you are starting to get more and more policies that have a nil retention with respect to true fundamentals, meaning if you want to make a claim with respect to a breach of a fundamental rep, you don't have to, that claim doesn't have to be subject to the retention. So you have all sorts of reasons for wanting to expand the scope of what is fundamental, but market dictates what is customary. And to Nate's earlier point, the typical fundamental reps that you would get are the ones that are truly so fundamental to the deal or to the business that you're buying that you just can't, you can't kind of characterize them as otherwise. Things like the organization of the target you're buying, the authority of the seller that you're dealing with, the cap table, et cetera. Nowadays, I think one interesting one that I'm starting to see getting more often is reps as to affiliated transactions. And this is particularly helpful where you're dealing with founders or sellers. They often have a bunch of related party arrangements in place as between the seller or the seller's cousins or family members or their trust vehicles or whatnot, and the target itself. And it's often very neat to be able to get fundamental treatment with respect to those particular reps. I would say another trend that is interesting to note is with respect to the no claims declaration requirement. So we call these NCDs, they're basically statements that the buyer has to give at closing, effectively saying, look, we as of today are not aware of any breaches of any of the reps in the purchase agreement other than as set forth in this no claims declaration. The point being, if you're aware of a breach and you disclose that, then that's going to be excluded from coverage. Where there's a significant rollover, insurance often require that sellers also provide a no claims declaration. Now, what is the threshold that ends up triggering that requirement? That depends. But we're starting to see buyers successfully push that threshold higher and higher and get away with sellers who are participating as rollover holders not having to provide a no claims declaration. So I think we put 40% as an example, but this may probably also be another example of one where we kind of negotiated it in a one-off that is not necessarily market nowadays. But we still have been seeing an upward trend with respect to where that percentage is getting. So pausing here for a second, again, Aaron, Dylan, any thoughts from you on what you're seeing this threshold be these days?
Yeah, it's definitely increased. I mean, I think a few years ago it was probably 25%. I think more market now is 35%, but not surprised to hear that an insurer was okay at a 40% threshold. So, oftentimes we'll see kind of guidelines in the insurer's initial quote. We try and, to the extent we know that there's a rollover, preview that in the submission, at least the expected percentage, and we can work through that once we kind of, well, we would try and get that confirmed before we move into underwriting.
Yeah,
And then
definitely.
also worth noting, just on the true fundamental reps, oftentimes I think would be helpful for this group is We have a, let's just call it a half dozen insurers that, are much better at underwriting healthcare opportunities than others. And we've seen them be willing to treat healthcare regulatory reps for additional premium, sometimes, somewhere 20, 25 basis points on the premium. So, like you said, if you don't ask, you can't get it. And there's insurers are always willing to discuss some of these policy enhancements.
The last point on this slide is on conditional exclusions. So insurers, they exclude what they view as uninsurable risks or known matters. There are instances, however, where insurers are able to kind of exclude a specific risk area pending post-closing buyers' satisfactory diligencing that particular area. And I'm not finding any issues. And assuming that is the case, then the insurers often agree to exclude that condition or remove that conditional exclusion post-closing once that's done. I think we're starting to see that come up more and more often, insurers being willing to accommodate that a little more nowadays, given sort of where the market stands, and especially relevant where the deal is moving extremely fast. There's a high appetite to insure that particular target, and just all diligence cannot be finished before closing. And so sometimes you're able to kind of get that as well. All right, should we move on to the next slide?
Yeah, so a little bit about claims. These are from our market leader, Euclid Transactional. They've been underwriting since 2016, and I think they've paid close to $1 billion in claims at this point. So, look, this is where the rubber meets the road. If the claims aren't getting paid, this product goes away. And I think a lot of people have a vested interest in claims getting paid. So fortunately, we've outside of a couple challenging claims here and here, we're pleased to report that the product is working well. I'll say on this slide, look, I think generally speaking, we see notices on claims in about one in every five policies. Given that deductibles have come down significantly, I expect that claim notice or that, that percentage to tick up. But it'll be more nuisance claims, right? So, the claim severity is there. I don't think that's going to automatically increase because deductibles have come down, but I think it'll increase kind of just claims activity for the insurers, the brokers, the buyers, and their advisors. And then on the next slide, before I forget, I will just say one of the reasons that we see nil retention on true fundamental reps is if you see in the bottom right corner, and this shows claims, type of claims by percentage, you'll see that, true fundamental reps, you've got, 10 basis points. So they're very low risk. So it's kind of an area that the insurers can give and say, look, this point we gave you on this point, but it's kind of low risk. On the flip side, the bulk of the reps find the breaches are around financial statement rep breaches. And regardless of whether or not the target is audited, we're still seeing a lot of activity there. And this is where the claim severity can pick up. I'm not aware of any, and Dylan and Lee can correct me if I'm wrong, but any other insurance policies that will pay based on a multiple as part of a purchase price, right? So, $1 million financial loss can quickly turn into a $10 million loss if it implicates a multiple. And that's where we're seeing, really the bulk of the claims. But we've seen a lot in the customer and supplier space recently. One that's took down a significant insurance tower. But it varies from deal to deal. But I think the takeaway here is, the bulk are in the financial statement rep breaches. And when we're thinking about claims, I mean, I think about it, they kind of fall into three buckets. So you have a clear breach and an easily defined loss. So perhaps like a tax audit, right? It's clear there's been a breach. We know what the loss is. Those are getting paid pretty quickly. A clear breach with, as a second bucket, would be a clear breach and a more challenging loss calculation. So something around financial statements that implicates a multiple. They're getting paid, but it can take a little bit longer. And then, the third bucket would be unclear breaches, but kind of a colorable claim. Is this is still a maturing market? There's a lot of reputational risk. So if we've got, a colorable claim, we're seeing those get paid too. But unlike some other insurance products, we don't really see the claims process as adversarial, right? This is a collaborative process. We see the insurers as our partners here. So we want to be, open and upfront as early as possible. So when we become aware of a potential rep breach and potential loss, we'll put the insurer on notice and offer up an introduction, an intro call just to kind of get everyone familiar. So typically the insured, the broker, their legal counsel, financial advisors, just, the more transparent we can be from the outset, the quicker the claim is going to get paid. I think working closely with all your advisors in a claims process is super helpful. I don't want to spend too much on claims other than, like I said, like this product goes away if claims are getting paid, and there's no evidence to the point that claims have it's been problematic. But I'm curious to see if June and Nate have any thoughts on their experience in that on claims so far.
No, I mean, I think the one that obviously just sticks out here the most is the financial statements, right? Just how important of a rep that is. And making sure, as a buyer that you have good quality of earnings that you're doing and that, you have robust financial statement reps too. And I think it also part of the reason, right, why you see financial statements as such a commonly brought claim is because the magnitude of loss is there. Is going to be pretty big, right? If there is a breach there, it's typically going to be high and it's going to be, almost undoubtedly above that retention that will necessitate you actually bringing a claim under your policy. Whereas some of these other, employment or government contracts or condition of assets, if there's a breach, it might not reach the retention threshold and, you might not just decide that it's a nuisance claim and not even bring it.
All right, so some drafting considerations. Where buyer relies on rep and warranty insurance with limited recourse against seller or a full walkaway deal, it can affect how you negotiate reps and warranties. Buyers can often request a broader set of reps, given obviously the limited recourse that buyer's going to have against seller post-closing. And sellers often concede to this or are able to accommodate to some level of broader reps. Obviously they have to be negotiated and reflect the third party negotiation a suite of reps for you to be able to get the maximum coverage on the rep and warranty insurance. But I think as a general matter, look, if you have limited recourse against sellers and you're relying on rep and warranty insurance, then you as the buyer are able to get a broader set of reps and warranties. Now, sellers, where they push back is with respect to reps that require a burdensome or unreasonable scheduling burden. If you are asking a rep in a rep to, if you're asking the seller to list, the top 2,000 customers, sellers often push back on that. Yes, that's going to help your reps and warranties and coverage, resulting coverage, but it's just unfeasible from a seller's perspective. So they do, that's the type of pushback that you're often going to get from a buyer's perspective. And then the other point to worth mentioning is the use of knowledge and materiality qualifiers. So Nate's going to cover that a little more in detail, but from an insurance coverage perspective, materiality qualifiers, so things like, hey, we are not, the company's not subject to any material litigation. So qualifiers of that sort, they get scraped, i.e., they get basically ignored for purposes of figuring out whether or not there's a claim under that there's a claim that's covered under the policy. Knowledge qualifiers do not get the same treatment. So knowledge qualifiers are things like, hey, to the knowledge of the company has no litigation. So that particular qualifier does not get the same scrape treatment. And so you'll often see from a buyer's perspective, if you have to have sellers agree to some sort of a qualifier, you would often try to push to replace knowledge qualifiers with materiality qualifiers. I would say another drafting point that you're going to see is with respect to survival periods. So in a walkaway deal, sellers will push to have effectively a statement that says, look, reps and warranties, the claims with respect to those, they don't survive, or you cannot bring them after closing. The survival period is zero. Policies often quote override that, and they do apply their own survival periods to 3 to 6 years, depending on whether or not it's fundamental. So that's another drafting point that you're going to see pop up. And then lastly, we talked about split retention and how sellers stand behind their portion of a retention. So the way you it actually kind of comes into play in the document itself is by way of either a holdback or an escrow. And you'll often see an indemnity provision built into the agreement, whereby you are able as a buyer, you are able to make claims with respect to breaches of non-fundamental reps. And to the extent you do have a claim, then you can go after the escrow. And you going into the escrow and using the escrow as your first line of defense, that's another way of effectively having the sellers bear their 50% or their whatever split of the retention. And that's how they quote have skin in the game in the policy.
Yeah, so I'll go through these next few things rather quickly just because I know there's some good content at the end of this presentation that I want to make sure we have time to get to. But yeah, I think the important thing here is just understanding that your rep warranty policy and your purchase agreement are not standalone of each other. They really do dovetail into each other, and you want to make sure that the terms are consistent with each other and that there's no contradictions. We talked about definition of losses historically. Underwriters would match silence in the purchase agreement and the policy itself. June kind of gave a nice brief overview of the materiality scrape. I think this is one of the more confusing, I guess, is the right way to say it, confusing provisions in a purchase agreement. You go through the reps and you negotiate all these materiality qualifiers and put them in all the right places. And then when it actually comes time to bring a claim, you just ignore them all. So, and that's one of the reasons why I think Aaron mentioned earlier that underwriters want to make sure that the seller's disclosing without respect to materiality. This is the reason why. It's because when you actually bring a claim, you read out that materiality that's in the purchase agreement. And then the last one on here is fraud. So again, this is another interesting concept where the purchase agreement and the RWI policy coincide. Regardless of what indemnification package you have, you're really always going to be able to bring a claim for fraud against the sellers. And as a seller, you're typically not that interested in the rep warranty policy. You'll review it. You want to make sure that it's right. But the one provision you really, really care about is the subrogation language and making sure that the only way that the underwriter can actually go after you as a seller is in the event of fraud. And again, you want to make sure that the language, both in the purchase agreement and the RWI, treat this the same way and that there's no contradictions there.
So, trying to go a little faster here. Some items to think about at the onset of the process are whether or not you're going to propose as the buyer a full walk-away deal, or you're going to require the seller to provide, split retention or to bear some of the underwriting slash premium costs of the rep and warranty insurance. So that's often negotiated at the LOI stage. Or something that that sellers often want to see from the onset. I would say if you do, as the buyer, suggest or propose that it will be a full walk-away deal, buyers often also include a note to the effect of, "Hey, look, yes, we are going to propose or rely fully on rep and warranty insurance and ensure that you do have a walk-away deal here, subject to us completing diligence and there not being material deal specific exclusions that result from our diligence." So that's an opening that you would often see buyers kind of leave in their LOIs to be able to negotiate out specific indemnities or whatnot that may result from the underwriting process.
Which is a good reason why you should always involve your lawyers in your LOI process. Just a little pitch for the lawyers there.
There you go. Let's see. We talked about allocating costs, handling carve-outs from the onset. I guess one quick point here, and this is maybe a little further down the negotiating process, but from a buyer's perspective, you do also want the ability to bring claims against both the insurers as well as the sellers to the extent you are able to negotiate an indemnity from the sellers. At the same time, from the seller's perspective, they're often going to push back on that. They will say, "Look, fine, we'll stand behind this set of reps or this set of liabilities. However, you first have to go through the rep and warranty insurance process. You have to deplete the escrow, deplete the retention, deplete the coverage they're under, and then only after that are you able to come after us." From the buyer's perspective, you do have to be mindful of the practical timeline that is involved here. If you are waiting for the full rep and warranty insurance process to play out, that may take a very long time. And so you often try to negotiate an ability to go after all parties, all recovery sources at the same time. And if you end up double dipping in the sense that you do get duplicative recoveries, then you have to reimburse for that duplication to the sellers. So that's something that often also pops up in the negotiating phase. Nate, want to talk about some seller drafting points?
Yeah, so putting on our seller hats here, what you really care about if you're selling your company is that there's very little recourse against you under the purchase agreement. You want buyer to solely rely on their RWI policy. You don't want them to then be able to go after you in the event that they're not able to recover under the policy. The provisions that you really care about in the rep warranty policy is the subrogation language. We talked about that. The other one is having a block right on any amendments under the policy that would be adverse to you as a seller. And specifically, that's with respect to the subrogation language there. And again, it's just, it depends on if it's a walkaway deal or if there's a split retention and sellers willing to stand behind fundamentals. But I think the important thing here is just recognizing as a seller, your preference is for buyer to solely rely on the RWI policy and have as little ability as possible to go after you for any claims.
So a little bit on the process and timing. Really goes in two stages. So for us to go out and get initial quotes, we just need a few items, an LOI, a CIM, or some company overview, company financials, and then we'd want to confirm what the diligence work stream is going to look like. A few years ago, we were trying to include draft agreements in all our submissions, but given kind of the competitive nature of the market at the moment, we just go out and solicit initial indications, and we kind of narrow the group down to the top few candidates, and then we'll get those folks to look at draft agreements. That can all happen over, the initial quotes can get turned around in a couple business days. If we've got a draft agreement, they could review that in a day or two. So we're typically in position to select a carrier within a week of going to market. But if time dictates and we need to get someone lined up real quickly, we can get that done as well. And then underwriting, we've touched on this before. It's diligence on the buyer's due diligence, right? So we'll get the insurer and their advisors into the data room. We'll share all the diligence reports, the draft agreement, and disclosure schedules. Once they have all that information, then we'll have an underwriting call, 60 to 90 minutes. They're kind of getting shorter. They used to be a couple hours where the buyer's deal team and its advisors will talk through the deal itself and the diligence process. We typically want to get that call scheduled, a few business days before an expected signing, because coming out of the call, we'll get some follow-up questions and any proposed policy exclusions. So we'll want to have some time to respond to those follow-ups and negotiate, tailor any proposed exclusions. So, over the course of 2 weeks, ideally, like we get brought in right before or right after an LOI gets signed up. That gives us plenty of runway. But the ability to underwrite really depends on, the insurer's availability of the diligence report. So once they have all the materials, it's typically a week or so from the time we get them what they need to being in position to bind a policy. And again, if it needs to be a protracted timeline, we've had underwriting calls and bound policies the next day. So, everyone here is here to support the transaction and make sure that the insurance isn't holding up the deal.
I think we can go ahead and skip this slide. I think we've covered most of this information already, so we can go ahead and move forward.
I'd turn over to Dylan to go through some of the other insurance as we wrap up here.
Yeah, and just to change topics on the call, and I'm obviously acknowledging and well aware that we're an hour and 20 minutes into an extremely detailed insurance call. So thanks everyone for bearing with us at this point, and I'll try and do my best to keep these slides and keep the points as concise as possible. But the next couple of coverages we're bringing up, not only because they're important both to you as buyers and as well as the executive team and the management team at the companies that you're buying, but they're important because they're going to require some sort of a decision from you in terms of what do we do with these insurance policies as part of our transaction? Do these policies stay or do they go? Do they survive the transaction and we're going to rely on them between the transaction from OldCo to NewCo, or do we separate them? Do we keep one policy and run it off, tail it off, specific to the old company, and then incept and buy a brand new policy for the new company? So more on that in a bit here, but just to give a brief overview, these are the executive liability coverages. They're also called management liability coverages. You'll see the three most important ones here: directors and officers liability, employment practices liability, and fiduciary liability. And hitting on each one of these very briefly, the D&O insurance is important because, frankly, it protects the directors and the officers and the management team of the business. None of them would do what they do. No one would sit on a board. No one would be an executive at a business if they didn't know that there was some financial protections there for actions that may arise out of their duties as a director or officer. The first line of defense that each of them will have, frankly, is the indemnification grant from the company, which is great. That's normal. We hope that the company will afford indemnification to the fullest extent permitted by law. But we all know that indemnity is only as good as the strength of the balance sheet of the business. And so that's where D&O insurance comes in to either completely replace or supplement the indemnification that's being granted to the directors and officers by the company. The policy covers many, many, many different things. Frankly, it covers everything except for what's excluded. But below in the bullet points, you'll see some typical allegations that we see in some of the complaints against our boards of directors and directors and officers. Moving into the middle, the employment practices liability insurance. This risk is created largely based on the Civil Rights Act of 1964 and the statute that basically says it's illegal to discriminate against people in the workforce. And it created various levels of protected classes. And all those protected classes now allow your employees to file claims of discrimination, as well as harassment, largely sexual harassment claims. So we have this insurance because this is a hard area of risk to manage. It's hard to completely oversee the day-to-day interactions of all of your employees throughout the organization. There's going to be bad eggs, there's going to be mistakes, there's going to be situations that are deemed one thing when in reality they could have been numerous different things. So again, the policy is here to provide coverage, defense cost coverage, and settlement dollars for things like wrongful termination, retaliation against an employee, sexual harassment, areas arising out of the Me Too movement. Finally, moving on to the right side, the fiduciary liability insurance is here to protect the business as well as those folks within the business who are tasked with being the fiduciaries, the trustees, and the managers of the various employee benefit plans, and most specifically with the retirement plans that may be sponsored by the businesses that you own. And so ERISA is the law that governs those particular benefit plans. And naturally, the ERISA law is the rules of the road that tells us what we should do and what we should not do. So the fiduciary policy covers us for breaches or perceived breaches of ERISA, as well as any errors or omissions in the administration of any of the benefit plans, which could cause financial loss to any of the participants. Lee, if you'll advance to the next slide. We'll quickly talk about cyber liability. I know that this is kind of an obvious insurance coverage to go through, but it is a much, much more complex insurance coverage than it looks like on the scene. Naturally, the cyber insurance is here to provide financial resources and insurance dollars related to when there is some sort of a cyber breach. Generally characterizing the costs that arise from a cyber breach, we put them into a few buckets. One are third-party liability costs, basically meaning those damages which we allegedly have caused to someone else arising out of our breach. For example, a large healthcare organization may lose personal health information or personally identifiable information either of its employees or those patients. Naturally, those who have had their information lost may suffer financial harm for which they're going to hold your company liable. So the lawsuit that may arise from that situation would be an example of a third-party cost to your organization. The next are first-party breach costs. These are costs which the company has borne upon itself. So for example, a business may be required to engage the services of various forensic vendors, legal vendors, others to come in and evaluate the scope and the severity of a situation, make recommendations as to how we may proceed. Again, those are costs borne specifically by the organization. Another important one is going to be loss of income, which could arise from a cyber breach. If I'm able to get into a system and shut down the organization to where they can't operate for a period of time, they're going to lose revenue, and that loss of revenue will be one of the larger areas of loss for a business. And then finally, the largest source of loss under the first party breach costs are going to be extortion and ransomware type of attacks. Lastly, the biggest bucket of, or another large bucket of areas of expense are going to be cyber crime, where based on a cyber infiltration into our system, folks are able to induce payments to be made and to go places where those payments are not supposed to go. And so reimbursement for those losses is another large area of risk under the cyber policy. So again, very, very high level overview of some of those main coverages. But again, we bring these up because there's going to be a decision that has to be made. And oftentimes what we'll recommend is that certain policies should be tailed off. They should be put into runoff, or an extended reporting period should be purchased. All those words are synonymous. They all mean the exact same thing. Basically, what that means is that we're going to keep a policy alive for an extended period of time for which we may report claims which arise in the future. So for an example, let's take a sexual harassment claim. There may be areas where employees have been sexually harassed, actually or allegedly, but they may not step forward to bring those claims and bring suit against the company for years down the road. So for a sexual harassment situation which occurred prior to close, but which does not get filed until years after close, the runoff policy would be there. It would still be alive to capture that claim. So the runoff policy attaches to the old company. It's basically the dedicated bucket in which to put all old company claims as we roll into the future. because we will want to separate the liabilities between old company and new company and allow the new company under your ownership to have a fresh start, a fresh loss history, and a fresh set of insurance policies which cannot be impaired or eroded by claims which tie back into the old company. So guys, that's it in terms of a quick overview of the management liability and the cyber liability policies, as well as potentially decisions to go into runoff. I know we've got 3 minutes left before we've called our time. So maybe I think we want to open it up to Q&A now. Is that right? If there are any.
Yeah, if there's any questions out there, you can simply take yourself off the microphone and ask it. I did receive a question offline about where this recording and the materials will be located. We have a resource library on our website, so if you've not yet checked that out, you should do so. In addition to this training, there's past trainings up there as well. And as we continue the 101 program, we will post materials to that resource library. And our next program will be on March 11th, and we'll focus on tax. So if you don't already have that on your calendars, please save the date. Look like any questions? Anything else from Gallagher or McDermott from the HICPE side of things? Thank you both very much for being here and for all of the great information. But any closing thoughts on your ends?
Yeah, I think obviously a lot of information here, but feel free to reach out, right? Whether it's deal specific or just in general, trying to get some more information here. I mean, between the two folks here and the parties that would go through this normally on the broker and the legal side should take you pretty far down the process, but it is an important part to make sure you're working with the right professionals on that. The market does change a lot, as Aaron noted, from 2020 to where it is today to, I'm sure there'll be another cycle that will change here going forward, which will be very different from a buyer and seller perspective. So feel free to reach out. Anything that we can do to be helpful with, obviously happy to support HICPE and its members, and we appreciate your time. McDermott, anything else to add?
No, we want to echo the same thing you just said. Our contact information is on the last few pages of the presentation deck. Any questions, feel free to reach out anytime. And thank you for your time. And thank you for inviting us to this training program.
Thank you so much, everybody. Take care.
Thanks. Have a great rest of your day. Thank you.
Thanks, everyone.
Bye-bye.